Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, Twimmel listeners, if you're a fan of our AI platforms coverage, and especially if you downloaded our first AI platforms ebook, Kubernetes for Machine Learning, Deep Learning, and AI, then today is your day. While we've been working tirelessly on TwimmelCom, I have also been working on book two in the series, The Definitive Guide to Machine Learning Platforms. And I am happy to say that it is finally available to download now. We created the book as a resource for ML, AI, and data science leaders and innovators to help guide their efforts in scaling and industrializing machine learning and deep learning in their organizations. In this book, we address questions such as, why invest in increasing your organization's capacity to deliver machine learning and deep learning models? What are the key barriers to delivering ML and DL models? How have organizations like Facebook, Airbnb, and LinkedIn overcome these challenges, and how can their learnings be applied to your organization? What are the state-of-the-art machine learning platforms and tools, and how can you put them to use? How can you develop an AI platform strategy to support your organization's goals? To access the definitive guide to machine learning platforms, visit twimmelai.com/AI platforms. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Angela Bassa. Angela is the Director of Data Science at iRobot. Angela, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks so much, Sam. I'm happy to be here.
I am super excited to have you on the show and to get into a little bit of what you're up to there at iRobot. To kind of get us started, I'd love to hear a bit about your background and how you came to be working at the intersection of robotics and data science.
Yeah, so my background is mathematics, and I came to the intersection of robotics and data science through an enormous amount of luck. I think most people who come into data scientific practice either come from sort of the analytical, mathematical, physics sort of background, or they come from computer science and software development and software engineering. And I am very much on the first camp, and I am trying to learn as much as possible from the second camp's fire hose. Okay. My academic training is in applied math. This was back at MIT. Since then, I left. My sort of journey into data science was always through a heavy use of data, but under many different disciplines. So I worked in investment banking, in strategy consulting, in agricultural technologies, and marketing and energy trading.
I noticed that you had an incredibly broad background set of experiences before you found your way into data science.
Yeah, I think it's sort of reflective of my personal and family history as well. So I'm a third generation immigrant. Uh-huh. And my family is sort of very transient and almost nomadic. And I think that has translated into my career as well. Okay. And it's also, all jokes aside, it's actually something that I find comes quite easily to me. So growing up, we spoke several languages at home, and I find it very easy now in a professional capacity to understand that some people are speaking HREs, whereas some people are speaking engineer-ese, mm-hmm. or some people are speaking analytics-ese, and to be able to provide that translational step has a huge amount of value, especially in a discipline like data science, where there's sort of this division between the tools and the mechanics of how you solve problems, mm-hmm. and the domain expertise of knowing which questions to ask and which problems are worthy of being solved first.
Right.
And so playing that midfield there has proven incredibly valuable and transferable, thank goodness.
Nice. You mentioned that your academic background was in applied math. What, any particular focus or flavor?
I liked graph theory quite a bit.
Okay.
I spent a lot of time in that domain, and also logic and first order logic, sort of model theory. But I learned very early on that academia wasn't going to be my thing. I just don't have the personality fit for that. More than a personality fit, I actually don't have the diligence to focus that long on a single mm-hmm. problem.
Yeah.
So I ended up going into industry where my particular flavor of ADHD is actually quite valuable.
I mentioned that you are at iRobot, as did you. I imagine folks are familiar with iRobot, but maybe you should share a little bit about the company and the focus of the company just to level set.
Yeah, happy to. So iRobot is, a lot of folks actually don't know, but iRobot is almost 30 years old. So we've been around for quite a while. I've been here for about 2.5 years now, and I started the data science practice here. We've been growing quite a bit over the last 2.5 years. But obviously, iRobot builds robots. And so we have lots of fantastic algorithmists and machine learning engineers, many of whom predate my tenure here. But now we have sort of a focused competency whose mandate it is to look at fleet data and to make sure that we are using that information and feeding that back into the development of products, into the customer experience, and into the strategy. So at iRobot, we're well known for our flagship product, which is the Roomba, the robotic vacuum cleaner. And we have a whole line of robotic vacuums. There's not just one. So depending on what specifically a customer might be looking for, we have different offerings with different levels of data-driven features and autonomy. And we also have the Brava line, which is a robotic mops. And we just announced earlier this year the Terra line of robotic lawnmowers. So more and more, we have this portfolio of autonomous products that can take care of your home so you can do other stuff. If you're like me, you can be a nerd. I'm what one would call an indoorsman. So I don't use my free time to go outside. But if you like that, then you can do that while your robots are back home, making sure that everything is sparkling clean.
You mentioned that you started the data science group there at iRobot. Did you do that from internally? Were you already at iRobot, or did you join the company to start the group?
The latter.
Okay.
So I was at a company called Enernoc before, and I was also brought in to run their data science team, although they already had the team in place when I joined. They had two or three people working in data science there at the time. And here at iRobot, I was the first data science hire that they had. And there's always, you know, pros and cons as to whenever you're starting a team, especially in established organizations. So it's very different if your product is data scientific. At that point, you probably have data science talent that's built in from either the founding team or at least very close to inception. Whereas when you're coming into an organization that is established and that has a product or an industry that they work within, and you're starting to infuse that organization with data and data-informed decision-making, there are certain times where it makes sense to start with more junior talent and just spelunking and figuring out what value you can extract from that data, or you can start very top-heavy and have more of a strategic or even a structural approach to it. And iRobot chose the latter, lucky for me. And I've been very diligently making sure that they never think that was a bad decision on their part.
How did the company even come to know that it needed data science? What precipitated, you know, creating the opening and opportunity for you to join the company?
So I like to believe that it's because some people with a lot of foresight who were here before me saw that as part of the vision, as a compelling part of the story of what we're trying to do. So when you read about what iRobot is doing right now, we're talking very openly about this bet that we're making on the smart home and what we think that smart home ecosystem is going to mean going forward. But it all started, you know, with a small step towards connecting our products to the cloud and allowing those products to leave artifacts for us to be able to inspect. And one of the things that has always been at the forefront here has been the utmost stewardship that we have of that data. This data is not being generated from, you know, pings that your mobile phone is making to the cloud that you carry on you. This is coming from inside your home. This is, you know, one of your most precious havens. And to allow somebody, to allow a company to come in and autonomously, right, peruse that environment and report back is something that has to be done with a lot of trust. And so I think part of the strategy internally was to make sure that all of that was in place before letting a whole bunch of nerds loose spelunking all that data. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you to elaborate a bit on what that data is and where it comes from.
Yeah. So in late 2015, we had our first connected product and we started aggregating that information. And so the information that we get always with the permission of our customers has to do with the functioning of the robot. So we're interested in identifying bugs before our customers are bothered by them, before they impact the functioning of the functionality of the robot. We're interested in understanding how our customers use their robots. So, you know, one thing that's always important to keep in mind is that I'm not the person who should be asking the questions, because I am a very specific type of nerd who has very nerdy questions. And there's only one of me, and there's millions and millions of all of us. So we as a company want to make sure that we're answering the questions of all of our customers. And so the data that we're collecting helps inform what our customers want from our products that maybe we haven't ideated yet. And then it helps us develop that. But one thing to keep in mind is that we, you know, we never sell that data. That data is not the thing that we make money off of. The data is essentially the thing that allows us to do what our customers want from their product better than anybody else.
Yeah, one of the things that I found, so I was at the AWS ReMars conference a few weeks ago, and iRobot had a big presence at that event as well. And you know, one of the things that I realized was that I just had a very dated view of the company and the products. Like, I remember when the Roomba first came out. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was pretty dumb. Like, you know, you just turn this thing on and it would like bounce in a wall and kind of randomly change direction. And the idea was that, like, if you kept this thing charged up enough and let it do it enough, it would eventually clean up, you know, a room, right? As opposed to, you know, what I saw today was, you know, there were some visualizations that were like a total, like a slam type of, you know, process where these robots have all kinds of sensors and they're like mapping out their environments dynamically and, you know, employing some relatively sophisticated, certainly relative to, you know, what I recall, algorithms to make sure that they're cleaning up all the parts of your house. And then you're getting into this notion of like collaborative cleaning with either multiple, like the, you know, how does the broom robot work with the mop robot to clean a house? Like, it's a lot more. It's like, it's not your, you know, not your father's Roomba anymore or something like that. It's a lot more sophisticated than I remembered.
Well, I think 15, 20 years ago, a lot of things in hindsight look dumber. I certainly look dumber when I think of myself 15, 20 years ago.
Touché.
But yeah. I think that's apt. So the robots today, I mean, the thing that happens with a company that has been around for almost 30 years is you have all of these code bases with a lot of institutional knowledge and a lot of love and passion embedded in there. And so it's hard to just say, yeah, we're going to start over. Yeah, no problem. All the people who came before, what could they have possibly known? Mm-hmm. And it's hard to do that, but that's sort of a little bit of what it takes. It takes discharging a lot of technical debt and starting fresh to be able to do all of these things. And today, you know, the Roombas and the Bravas, they can, some of the models, they can work together. So you can tell your Roomba and your Brava to tag team on a task. And so your Roomba might know exactly where it is. And so if you want the kitchen and the dining room to get cleaned and mopped, then the Roomba can dispatch and go to the kitchen, finish. As it's moving to the dining room, it communicates with the Brava mop that the kitchen is all done, that it, the mopping can start there, and it moves into the dining room. And then when it's finished with the dining room, it lets the Brava know that it can follow along. And so then both of those rooms get vacuumed and mopped, and you don't have to lift a finger. And with the Roombas, those also have the clean base now. So the top models have the clean base. So the Roomba can dock itself, and the base vacuums the bin of the robotic vacuum and stores that. So you don't have to touch it for sometimes weeks or months at a time until you have to empty the clean base. So this idea of autonomy is something that at least our modern product line is already delivering on, and the whole product line is always evolving towards. But what we're going towards really is beyond autonomy, which is something that Colin Engel, our CEO, talked about at Remars as well, which is intelligence isn't autonomy, right? If you autonomously can do something, that's great. That's better than not doing it and to require active direction. But if you can coordinate and if you can be responsive and collaborative, and if you can be part of a system that enables all of that collaborative, responsive autonomy to take place, then you're really talking about the transformative power of data, which is sort of what we're building our platform to be able to leverage.
Is there an example of that in the context of Roomba in particular, or robotics, or iRobot in general, like how intelligence is, you know, greater than autonomy?
Yeah, I think the one example would be if you can send a robot to perform a mission, right, in the parlance. So if you can send a robot to go and clean a room, that's great. But if you can tell that robot where in that room to spend more of its time, either because you know that there's a particular stain, or you know that there is a particular area that needs to be focused on, or if you know that that another robot in the family should follow along. And so if you can report back that you've identified there's something amiss in this region or that region. So the way that Colin sort of articulated it, which was really clever, not just because he's my CEO, I actually thought this was very clever, is if you think of the example of astronauts, right? If you have somebody who is able to make it to the moon and back, that's great. But if they're, or make it to Mars and back, but if they're there and they have gone through a battery of training to make sure that they can withstand the journey, they don't have infinite RAM, so they can't know all of the things. So if you have somebody back in Houston who can tell them, hey, that rock over there that you're not paying any attention to because you're not a geologist, but I am, pick it up and bring it home. Bring a sample because I want to know what that is, right? So if that relationship goes beyond just a relationship of autonomy, but a relationship of responsiveness, so that you can act on that information while it is relevant rather than only after the payload has been delivered, that's really where we're driving towards.
And so when you think about applying data science in this context, how do you break down the different roles and places that you're applying data science? And I guess I'm thinking of it kind of crudely in terms of use cases, maybe. Like, you know, I'm imagining you could apply this to, you know, certainly the autonomy of the robots within the home. There are like predictive maintenance types of use cases. There are like business things, like how many of the people that buy these things actually use them, and how many of the people, you know, that, you know, buy them and use them a lot probably want to see like the next bigger version because, you know, their current one, you know, isn't doing something as good as it could be. Or like, what are all the, like, how do you think about, not what are all of them, but how do you taxonomize the different ways that data science plays at iRobot?
I think the way that I like to think about it is in terms of the utility of each of the different projects and their priority within the greater strategy that we have, both in R&D and in iRobot as a whole. So especially as I was saying before, when you have a company that has a product that is data scientific, right? The thing that you are selling is the knowledge that you have about the data that you collect. It's a completely different ballgame. But in the sense of iRobot, where our product is this physical robot, and the data really plays a supporting role to that, I think the thing that you want to focus on is the fact that data science is not a cheap investment. And so as I stood up the practice here, the first thing that was top of mind is making sure that we demonstrate a return on that investment. Because the thing that I have seen happen in similar cases is that there's this image of the potential of what this practice could deliver. And then that potential isn't realized in the very near term. And everybody gets disenchanted and it becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy that it was never going to work. Mm-hmm. And that happens over and over when you're talking outside of sort of the Silicon Valley data-driven startup ecosystem. And that's the thing that I was most cognizant of, is what are the things that we can deliver in the very short term with the information that we already have. I don't want to re-architect anything yet. I don't want to change how our software gets developed or how data gets encoded and ingested and transformed, processed, stored, all of that. Based on the things that we've inherited, what exists of value that we can deliver in the very short term? And then based on the momentum that you can generate there, you can start recruiting champions and you can start recruiting stakeholders that can help you make the more foundational changes mm-hmm. that enable really big bets. So here at iRobot, you know, one of the big bets that we're making is on the smart home and what that will mean and who will win in that space. And our bet is that we will win because of both our capability and our expertise and our commitment to customer privacy and all of these things rolled into one. But that's not something that could have been accomplished in the first 6 months. Right. And so I really try to think in terms of sort of your near term horizon and your long term horizon. So your near term horizon are the things that your data is already bringing to you that if only somebody were to pay attention to it. Right. You could make smarter decisions. And so those are easy. You just need to dedicate the time and effort to look at the tactical, chat across the organization to figure out who could make better decisions if only somebody could help them understand how things are getting used. And that's all already instrumented. But that's really sort of quote unquote bootstrapping the really big play, which then requires, improved data architecture and all of the things that come downstream from that in terms of data quality, lineage, governance, mm-hmm. all of those other things that are important.
Yeah, I find this conversation really interesting. And it's one that when I talk to folks that are, running data science organizations or, machine learning AI organizations, centers of excellence, things like this, the whole concept of how they manage and balance their portfolios so as to kind of demonstrate short-term value, enough short-term value while also kind of keeping their eye on, a broader vision and, selling that or making progress to that. Like, it's a very delicate balance in a lot of places and one that, a lot of energy is put towards.
Yeah, and it's really easy to sort of hire a team. I mean, it's not easy, but it's quite possible to hire a team of 100 people, mm-hmm. All, experts and really fantastic professionals and throw them at a problem. And then they will, you know, come up with all of these, they really are fantastic ideas that will require 2 years of additional instrumentation and further investment. And I like to joke that if we were to do the things that I want to do, we go bankrupt, because I'm not the target audience for this, right? There are lots of robotics companies that find it very difficult to stay in the market for as long as iRobot has to do these things in a cost-effective way. And that's the game for us, is how can we deliver on the promise of consumer robotics in a way that isn't going to extinguish itself, because, you know, we've bitten off more than we can chew. So this very measured approach can be quite frustrating at times, because it can feel like you're funding the least interesting parts of the journey, when in fact it's quite the opposite. What I feel like I'm doing is I'm clearing the midfield so that my key players can then be able to take amazing shots without having this constant oversight and this demanding voice that why haven't we paid for ourselves yet?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sounds like you're a football fan.
I am, and I call it football. For me, it's soccer. So for folks who might be listening and who don't know, I was actually born and raised in Brazil, and I have just started to learn American football rules. So now it gets really confusing.
Nice. So how big is the data science team there now?
So we have a blended team. So we don't have just data scientists in our data organization, which is also something that I think is fundamental to our success so far. We started with data scientists, but as we've grown the portfolio of solutions that we offer internally and in our production environment, we've been adding specializations. So we have a blended team of data architects, data stewards, data engineers, data analysts, and data scientists that help us cover all of the different things that we have on our roadmap.
How many on the data team there?
So on the data team per se, I think we have 12 people right now.
One of the things that I wanted to dig into a little bit is how you have built out processes and platforms to support delivering models into production and, you know, doing the work of the team. Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, both the philosophy there, but also like try to get us to kind of concrete details around, you know, some of the things you're doing?
So for a company like iRobot, one of the things that we had to do was we had to discharge a lot of technical debt. So a lot of our products originally were each one independent a platform. And so they had a code base and all of the ancillary things that go with that, that were independent of each other. And that made it so that each platform was robust, and there are lots of benefits with that in terms of manufacturing. But one thing that proved less than helpful was the fact that there was very little modularization. So it was hard to be able to reutilize learnings and to shift priorities as they needed to happen. So one of the things that we recently underwent was a reorganization where we brought data science specifically closer to engineering and closer to product management. And we've also created a new design language and a shared code base that's modularized so that the different pieces of the software can be interoperable. And so things like navigation and mapping, things like Wi-Fi connectivity and all of those parts of the platform can now be almost plug and play with the different products that we develop. And what that does is it really allows us to be much faster in our ability to write software. And so what we're moving towards are these robots that become smarter over time. So hardware is very different than software. You can't just release an OTA and get new hardware and new injection molded plastic in people's hands, mm-hmm. but you can do that with software. And so if we can have a smart platform that is part of the hardware that can receive improved direction over time, then that allows us to be able to solve the problems that our customers have in more intelligent ways. Mm-hmm. And so we essentially embarked on that not too long ago, and we've been operating under that model for the for all of 2019, essentially, where we have now a DevOps culture, and we have a cloud culture, and we have a data-driven culture that is imbued into all of the different teams so that they can leverage the power of this new design language that is shared across all of our products.
Mm-hmm. And so when you say design language, what does that really mean?
So it means a lot of things. One of the things, for instance, is we used to have homegrown coding language for some of our robots because of the restricted nature of the compute that was available to them, which is perhaps what might have made them feel less than intelligent 15, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But moving forward into the present and the future, that just wasn't going to cut it. And so a lot of our code base right now is in Python. And that helps both in terms of attracting talent, but also in terms of shifting talent around and shifting learnings around.
And are we talking about code on the robot or code somewhere else?
Yes, and. So yeah. Not all of the parts are in the new paradigm yet, because this is a transition, but a lot of it, both on robot and off. And also in terms of the types of things that can happen on the robot, you know, there's a lot more power that the robots have, you know, for the things that they're capable of doing right now. So if you're going to have teaming take place, all of that needs to happen, and it needs to happen on the edge so that information doesn't necessarily need to get sent back home for things to work the way that they should.
Sure. Yeah, it strikes me that there's, you know, platform in this conversation is going to be a little overloaded in the sense of the robot itself is a platform. It's a hardware platform. And then you've got a software platform sitting on that hardware platform. And then you've got, that's presumably connected to the cloud, right? That, exactly. AWS, that's a platform. And so, you know, in that kind of environment, where does DevOps come into play, and how is that used presumably to help tie all these things together?
So the way that it comes into play is twofold. I think one is just as a mentality that all of the software developers need to have in terms of the level of ownership of code. But on top of that, I think as you described, a different layering. So we want to have folks work on the things that they're good at, the things that they're passionate at, and not on the things that are unnecessary. So the same kind of mentality applies to data science. And I'm going to speak to data science because that just comes more easily to me. But in both data science and machine learning, you want to have that same DevOps culture where you don't want to spend 80% of your time cleaning data. You want to spend 80% of your time figuring out how your data is dirty and then writing code that solves it. So the next person doesn't have to do that as well. So that has to come individually from each member of our team, but we also have a team dedicated to maintaining all of those different layers, both on the hardware platform, the software platform, and the cloud platform. I don't know if that answers your question.
Kind of. It starts to get us there. What is that team called?
So that team is the Cloud Ops team.
I guess one question that I've got is, you know, as a company that kind of ships these products that are inherently platforms, I'm wondering if you also have like horizontal, you know, platforms or tools or processes that are, you know, just how you develop models at iRobot or how you, you know, do experimentation or how you do deployments that are kind of independent of the individual robotics platforms, or, you know, because you're developing these like highly integrated things, you know, is everything very specific to one product?
Well, that's the crux of it. So we were handicapped by the fact that we were faced with exactly what you're describing, where we had all of these different distinct platforms. And so as you well know, and as your audience knows, machine learning requires a lot of training data. Mm-hmm. And so how can we train these models with the ultimate objective of having them be as robust as possible? And so there's a lot of information that that these different formerly distinct platforms were collecting that weren't distinct at all. So that information should be able to all be used, but it couldn't because they were coming in through disparate mechanisms, using different schemas, using different code bases. And so part of this re-architecture has really been to have a unified, and we call it a design language, because it applies both to the industrial design of the hardware, but also the code plasticity underlying all of that. And so now that we have this unified, shared platform, all of the information that comes in is much more readily available for utilization in different models. And so part of what we're doing is increasing the personalization of our products. And to do that, you know, if you're interested in ever increasing autonomy, you don't want to have to worry about actually sending your robot out to clean your home. You want that to just automatically happen, and you don't want to have to worry about it. And so one of the things that we imagined we should do, and now we do, is as you are using your robot over time, we learn how you like to clean your home, when you like to clean your home. Are there specific rooms that you like to clean with different rates? And so we can make recommendations for you on when you should run your robot or during what times in what rooms, so that you can just say, yes, please do this for me and stop bugging me. Right. And then the robot will take over. And if you have one with a clean base, then the robot will take over and it will run its cleaning missions on the frequency that you've specified. And you only touch it when the clean base is full. And so one of the things that's important to keep in mind with something like that is you're actively telling your customer to not engage with your product. So you have to make sure that you've covered all your bases so that your product is working as intended in an unsupervised way for as long as it does.
So what's the experience from the data scientist perspective? Like there's now post this re-architecture, is there a centralized place like a data warehouse or something where they access all of this data? And then are there specific tools that they are able to use now to build models that are independent of, you know, where those models are ultimately gonna run from a robot perspective? What services or experiences does that layer provide for the data scientists that need to work on these different models for these different robots?
It really depends on the use case, right? So if you have a robot and your robot has sent you a message for whatever reason, and so it's blinking and you go and you look in your app, and if your app is not reflecting exactly what your robot is saying, you're going to think that we don't know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's one use case where it's, you know, it has to be extremely low latency and fairly high concurrency. So that use case for our data management is very specific Whereas for the data scientists, as you asked, we don't really have a need for extremely low latency, because it's sort of a research environment that as we discover things that we would like to do, we can then go into our data lake and swim in it. So there are these different architectures that serve different purposes as well they should. So in our data lake environment, where our data scientists are doing a lot of their researching, that's now a centralized place that has reduced a lot of the overhead that our data scientists need. So a lot of the processing is taking place centrally, and we've abstracted a lot of the complexity of aggregating and transforming all of that in our lake, so that the data scientists are essentially dealing with derived data sets that already are in the format that is shared across all of our different products and all of our different platforms, so to speak.
That data lake, what is that? Is that S3 or Redshift or something else, or some combination of, you know, other things?
It's a combination because of the different requirements of how that those different data stores are traversed. So for the data scientific case in particular, we rely quite a lot on Athena.
Okay.
For the querying and the creation of extracts for research. One important thing to note as well is that there are significant access controls to all of these different parts of the environment. And there are also the different parts of the data lake that can be hashed or tokenized. So I don't necessarily need to know what you call a particular room. I just need to know that you care enough that you've named things, right? Like, I don't need to know what you call your robot, but I would like to know that you love it enough that you've named it. So those types of data care and maintenance are the things that we've centralized, so that you don't have to worry whether the data scientist knows enough to not go spelunking when they're not supposed to. And we're really trying to protect our data scientists from themselves.
And so you've got this data lake environment that is Athena and other things, depending on the use case. What are the types of tools that data scientists are typically using there? Are you doing a lot of deep learning types of things with TensorFlow and that kind of stuff, or scikit-learn, or... what does the modeling experience look like from a data scientist perspective at iRobot?
I tried not to be too dogmatic, just because different tools are appropriate for different use cases. So when we're still in the ideating and researching phase, we've used things that run the gamut. And one of the things that I mentioned is once these processes are actually running on the robot, they're running in a resource-constrained environment. So when we're learning things about the information that we have access to, those are running on our own hardware, our own compute. Not necessarily our own hardware. Sometimes Amazon owns the hardware, but still, we have a lot more flexibility with what we use and how it will be appropriate. And then it's on us for whatever algorithms need to run on board the robot to make sure that they're optimized so that they can run in the restricted compute environment. So as far as what we're using, I mean, yes, we do use TensorFlow. We use different libraries. We certainly use scikit-learn as well. And in terms of what kind of methodologies we're using internally, I mean, you mentioned SLAM. You know, iRobot has a pretty strong published presence in the development of vSLAM, but there are a myriad other algorithms that we use as well. And we have teams that focus on deep learning. We have a team that focuses on reinforcement learning, for all sorts of different use cases that I can't actually describe yet until we launch, but they're imminent. So we have a pretty strong bench in terms of the different methodologies that we make use of.
And I mentioned, we both mentioned SLAM at this point, and I did not define it earlier. It's simultaneous. Simultaneous, is that the S?
Localization and mapping.
Localization, yep, and mapping, right. Yeah. So how the robot's able to go out into the world and kind of figure out where it is and map it, its environment.
And if you've never seen it, it's pretty remarkable.
It's a pretty awesome demo, yeah.
It is, and I have a million robots. it's one of the perks of the job, having to test all of these things. But
nice.
I actually have, I also have a young son. And so we have child gates, sort of baby gates all over the house. And it is remarkable to see the robots sort of figure out, oh, nope, I can't go this way. And to, it goes all the way around the floor map to find another point of entry to the room that I wanted to clean. Oh, so wow. It's actually quite smart. And it's, you know, we forget, we who do this professionally, you live in the zeros and ones and the code. And to actually see a piece of hardware take that knowledge and apply it, it is actually really, really cool, which is something that in previous roles I didn't necessarily have. But to see that mobile sensor platform take direction and utilize it and tangibly move around its environment and understand its spatial components.
Right.
It's actually really fun.
So we've talked a little bit about data access. We've talked a little bit about modeling. I guess kind of last question in this vein, deployment. How are you deploying models so that they're kind of accessible for inference? Like I'm thinking about AWS has like this green grass thing where you can like deploy models out to the edge, or I'm assuming that the iRobot platforms aren't like green grass endpoints, or that you're running, I don't know, you tell me, are you running like serverless model deployment on the robots and that kind of thing, or how funky does it get?
Yeah, so we're pretty bought into the serverless architecture paradigm. And so that is essentially how most of the platforms run okay. on our side. But in terms of deployment for the algorithms that run on the edge, we actually have an OTA pipe. That because the
OTA being what over ends the up, air, like how you
sorry,
update
thank
the
you,
robot.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. I forget my TLAs aren't everybody's TLAs. three-letter acronym. So thank you. We because these things are running on a autonomous vehicle. I mean, these mm-hmm. aren't, you know, on the streets, they're in your home's hallways. And so once we introduce those models into the platform software and we compile it and we ship it, there's an extensive amount of testing that needs to happen so that, you know, if you're a customer and we're sending you these really cool new features, the thing you want this robot to do is vacuum your home. That's mm-hmm. what you went and got this robot for. So that's the thing that we never want to compromise. And we make sure that any new features that we introduce, be them data scientific or not, is we have to go through this extensive battery of testing to make sure that the robot still functions and it's not going to, you know, act all crazy because it's hardware. It's not just that the zeros and ones are going to fly through the screen. No, the robot is a thing that can hit your puppy. So yeah. We definitely don't want that to happen ever. So we don't have an over-the-air pipe that delivers just new model features. But what we do is we have this robust system for delivery, both to factories and to customers. And that's all delivered through AWS, but it's not Greengrass because that would be specifically just for model deployment.
Well, Angela, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me about just a little bit of what you've got going on there. It sounds like really interesting stuff and probably that we need to like follow up at some point to go into more detail.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love that. And thank you so much for the opportunity to nerd out.
Absolutely. Thanks, Angela.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. If you like what you've heard, please do us a favor and tell your friends about the show. And if you haven't already hit that subscribe button yourself, make sure you do so you don't miss any of the great episodes we've got in store for you. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.